uncovers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome to our program, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you. Broadcasting live on radio stations from California to Pennsylvania, streaming down from outer space on the Sirius satellite radio system, beaming around the planet on radiopower.org, whiterosesociety.org, podcasting on Apple's iTunes. Welcome to our program. Warren Belmar is a media spokesman for the Republican National Lawyers Association, and he's with us today. Warren, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you, Mr. Hartman. A pleasure to join you.
Thank you for joining. Am I pronouncing your last name correctly?
Belmar? You have it correct.
Okay, great.
May I call you Tom?
You certainly may. Please do. Are you an attorney, Warren?
I am a retired partner with the law firm of Fulbright & Jaworski and still practice from time to time.
Okay, so they've got you guys out there doing the talk show circuit and in promotion of John Roberts' nomination here to the Supreme Court. I appreciate your coming on the program to talk with us today. One of the things that concerns me the most about John Roberts' nomination is that he seems to be siding with Scalia and Thomas in this concept of what they refer to as originalism. Back in October of last year, I was living in Vermont at the time, and Scalia came to the University of Vermont Law School and said, every time the Supreme Court, I'm quoting him directly here, he said, every time the Supreme Court defines another right in the Constitution, it reduces the scope of democratic debate. Now, maybe I'm just old-fashioned, but I remember well, in fact, I wrote a book about the debate between Jefferson and Madison and Hamilton about whether or not there should even be a Bill of Rights in the Constitution, because, as Hamilton points out in Federalist Number 84, the Constitution is a Bill of Rights, that we are the holders of the rights. Scalia, in fact, went on to say, again, and I'm quoting Justice Scalia, abortion, gay rights, and the right to die are best left to the legislative and executive branches. You want a right to abortion? Pass a law. I thought we passed laws to limit rights, not to give us rights. Sir.
It was
a bit of a speech, but the reason why I said this is because I've got this thing in front of me here from today's paper that says in 1981, John Roberts wrote disparagingly of a case in which he said the courts had established rights not specifically defined in the Constitution. The case he cited involved, quoting John Roberts, a so-called right to travel and related to residency requirements for welfare recipients. And is he not suggesting, I mean, there's this movement. You've got Scalia, Thomas, and now Roberts, three people on the Supreme Court saying we don't have rights unless we pass a law?
Tom, I think that's perhaps misunderstood. I could certainly understand everyone's concern on what do people stand for. But let me back up, if you would, for just one second. The American Bar Association, which according to Senator Leahy is the gold standard for evaluating judges, has evaluated Judge Roberts three times and each time found him well qualified. The standards that the American Bar Association has used forever in evaluating candidates for the judiciary are threefold. Does the nominee possess the integrity to be a judge? Does he possess the professional competence to be a judge? And does he possess the judicial temperament to be a judge? In three occasions, Judge Roberts has been found to satisfy those and get the highest rating of the ABA.
Sure. And
the last time it happened, he was unanimously confirmed by the Senate of the United States without a dissent. Now, in that context,
Warren, I'm not disputing any of that.
Context, we need to be afraid of his taking away rights or giving rights.
Well, actually,
we have God-given rights. If you go to the Declaration of Independence,
well, that's not what Scalia says.
Well, I don't know that that's exactly
what
Scalia says or doesn't say, but you have no, we're not talking about the confirmation of Justice Scalia, who is also unanimously confirmed by the United States.
That's my point. I mean, to say, if your main talking point is that the ABA says that he's well qualified.
No, it's not a main talking point. It's a talking point. The reason I was bringing that up is because some of the things that are being thrown around really relate to these criteria, but indirectly. If you are thinking that a person cannot have personal opinions, that's certainly not the rule.
I'm not suggesting
that. But the rule of judging is, as Justice Roberts alluded to yesterday, and I think quite eloquently, that the judge is an umpire. Now, if you feel that the umpire cannot be impartial, then he's lacking in integrity. And if he's lacking in integrity, he shouldn't be confirmed. But if you're willing to assume that the person has integrity, then one puts those personal views aside. When
but Warren Belmar, that's a very imperfect analogy, because an umpire is rendering decisions based on rules that are not in dispute. And a judge on the Supreme Court is deciding what the rules are. That disingenuous thing for John Roberts to say, because really what a Supreme Court justice does is they don't say, okay, that was a strike or a ball. They say, what is a strike or a ball? And that's a very different thing.
You're absolutely right, Tom, and I couldn't agree more. But for 200 years, this has been going on. And all of a sudden, we have new questions as to what are strikes and what are balls. And to the extent that those are presented as de novo issues, then the court will have to address it.
Well, I think one of the concerns is that
they're not de novo issues. We do know that there's a right to vote. We do know there's a right to privacy, as the Supreme Court has stated. And those are precedents that any judge will follow in trying to understand what the next answer is to the next question.
Actually, you have Scalia echoing language from the Griswold case saying that he can't find a right to privacy in the Constitution.
We're not talking about Justice Scalia.
I know, but
Justice... We're talking about nominee John Roberts.
Right. Do we want another guy who's cut in the mold of Scalia and Thomas? Because Roberts seems on every issue to be right in that same camp. I realize that...
How do you come to that conclusion, Tom? Can you give me some examples
sure,
of what
Roberts
has said?
Yeah, I would be glad to. In 1991, when he was Deputy Solicitor General, he signed a government brief urging the reversal of Roe v. Wade. In that, he's right there with Scalia and Thomas.
No, he was in there with the administration that he was serving in, called the first Bush administration, advancing a position that his client had.
And Scalia and Thomas.
And many other people. But that
certainly
was just position of the elected government of the United States, hardly out of the mainstream.
Well, arguably. We need not get into that. And he opposed affirmative action programs. He opposed the Voting Rights Act.
Where did he oppose affirmative action programs?
I am reading from the Associated Press today. In the Reagan and first Bush administrations, he opposed affirmative action programs as quotas. He protested an expansion of the Voting Rights Act, saying it could, quote, lead to a quota system in electoral politics. In 1990, he urged an end to, quote, forced busing for school desegregation, end quote, and supported a move in Congress to, quote, strip the federal courts of jurisdiction over school prayer, end quote.
Well, these are positions that were reflected in some of the documents that have come out, and you are taking them out of context one by one. Because you don't favor busing doesn't mean that you favor discrimination or segregation. I would love to know the context of the case, the context in which the comment was made,
then,
and whether,
if that's the case,
the facts to be, Tom,
if that's the case, Warren, if you would love to know the answer to that, Warren, then why don't you support the Bush administration releasing all those papers from when he was Deputy Solicitor General?
I was hoping you'd ask that, Tom, because that is one of the biggest misunderstandings that is currently being propagated in the whole debate. The Solicitor General's office is the most respected legal firm, law firm in the world. It has as its client the United States of America. We have in the practice of law, as you well know, something called attorney-client privilege. That applies not just to government officials, but to private practitioners, you and me, when we hire an attorney. That has been embedded in our system because we find the system works best when you can give candid advice or candid analysis of problems, discuss it, and not have it on the front page. Now, the ability to waive that privilege is possessed by the party who has it. In this instance, it's the government. In my case, in your case, it's up to us. Let me ask you a question, Tom. If John Roberts had been your lawyer on a controversial litigation matter that you unfortunately were involved in, and it was the only matter that addressed an issue of current concern, would the Senate be entitled to have any correspondence between you and John Roberts?
I am a private citizen. I am not the government. I am not we the people. My salary is not paid for by taxpayer dollars. I am not supposed to be operating in a transparent fashion.
It's not a transparent fashion when you're.
Our government
legal
is supposed
to
be functioning in a transparent
States.
Function.
Living Solicitor General of the United States got together when this issue first came up on the Miguel Estrada confirmation process. Mm-hmm. And every living Solicitor General, Democrat and Republican, said that the office doesn't work that way, it would be wrong for those papers to be released, and they all urged the president to not do it. Democrat and Republican.
Really what this is boiling down to, Warren Belmar, media spokesperson for the Republican National Lawyers Association, really what this is boiling down to, isn't it pretty much that what we have is a difference of opinion about the direction that this guy's probably going to take the court? I mean, that's a yes or no. I'm sorry, we're out of time.
I think the answer is yes.
Yeah, I think that's what it's coming down to.
But
okay.
I am convinced of his integrity, ability, and temperament, and therefore I am convinced that he will be a judge who will rule the way the law specifies.
Okay, thank you, Warren Belmar, for being with us today. Much appreciated. It's 17 minutes past the hour.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
And there are lies in the balance. There are,
you tell him, Jackson Brown.
There are children and the kids. There is blood on the wall.
And welcome back, my friends. 21 and a half minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. This is a big deal. John Roberts out here, essentially, I've heard a few clips of this over the last couple of hours of his being questioned before the United States Senate. And in many ways, it reminds me of Carlos Marcello before the United States Senate, or before the House of Representatives. No, it was the Senate. It was the Senate Investigative Committee. Bobby Kennedy was grilling him as the Attorney General back in 1962. And Marcello, the mob boss from Louisiana and Santo Trafficante, his buddy from Florida. And Kennedy would ask him a question, and he'd kind of growl, and he'd say, you know, based on my rights under the Fifth Amendment, sir, I decline to answer that question. I invoke my Fifth Amendment right not to incriminate myself. Sir, I'm not going to answer that question. So now you got Roberts saying, well, you know, because Ruth Bader Ginsburg didn't answer some questions, I'm not going to answer some questions. Turns out that the characterization of Ginsburg is, first of all, plain old flat-out false. Just plain old flat-out false. And Ginsburg actually did answer questions about abortion. She did answer questions about privacy rights. She did answer questions about prayer in school. She did answer questions about gun control. She did answer questions about all the really hot-button issues of the day. The few that she didn't answer were in cases that were pending before the Supreme Court at the time that she was being questioned. And so, you know, there are, I suppose, appropriately some areas where Roberts should not speak, but not right across the board. What he's trying to do is get through squeaky clean, and the Bush administration is stonewalling the release of all these papers. You have 18 senators now have signed this letter to George Bush saying, hey, please release these papers. The United States Senate, you know, we can keep a secret. Come on, we see the national security stuff, we see the CIA stuff, we can see the papers. No, says the Bush administration. Oh, it's covered by lawyer-client privilege. Excuse me, the client is the government of the United States. That's us. We were the employer of John Roberts. We should have some right to that. Our telephone number, 866, toll-free across the United States, 1-866-889-8894. Chris in Tampa, Florida. Hey, Chris.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
I am great, but I'll get better. What's up?
You know, Warren was parroting a lot of the Republican talking points that Orrin Hatch was going over today with the three measures that the bar uses to determine whether a judge is fit, and how he was confirmed all three times. It was the exact same thing I had the opportunity to watch earlier today. We're fighting a well-oiled Republican machine.
Oh, I know. That's why I had the guy on. I just, you know, want to say this is, it's the Republican National Lawyers Association. I mean, surprise, surprise. And they solicited us. I mean, they're contacting every talk show in the country, local or national, and saying, hey, would you like to have us on? And we said, sure.
You know, and they talk about and one of the things he talked about today was the separation of the branches of government. That's a line that just becomes more skewed by the day that Congress loses its power to, you know, to really rein this president in when he's gotten a little out of line, I think. You know, and they take the same attack. They didn't disseminate papers the same way they didn't do it with John Bolton. They have the strategy. It's worked before for them, so they're just going to keep doing it until we figure out a way to stop. It's a frustrating situation to be in. I voted for Bush once, but I made that mistake only once.
Yeah.
And yeah, a grim mistake, Chris.
I got to tell you, but don't feel bad because he wasn't actually elected.
Right. No.
So it wasn't your vote. It wasn't your vote. Thanks a lot for the call, Chris. It's good to hear from you. I appreciate it. Greg in Houston, Texas, on the line. Hey, Greg, what's up?
Hi, Tom. Hey, I want to know what you feel about, or how you feel about the Bush rescinding the Davis-Bacon Act.
These guys are contorting themselves like pretzels when they talk about this. First, a little history. The Davis-Bacon Act was passed back in the early 1930s when the government was getting involved in some disaster relief and reconstruction projects, specifically so that if government money goes into a region to rebuild something after a disaster, or for any purpose for that matter, that money coming into that region doesn't blow up the local wage scale. In other words, if you go in, you know, the relationship between how much people are paid, that is the cost of labor, and the availability of labor or the demand for labor is a proportional relationship. As you know, it's a supply-demand relationship. And so if you go into a region and you just start throwing money around and saying, okay, we're going to hire a whole bunch of people, then you're going to have people who will say, well, I'll work for $4 an hour. No, I'll work for $3 an hour. No, I'll work for $2. And you start bidding down the cost of labor. So the Davis-Bacon Act was put into place to prevent government from causing the cost of labor in a local market from being bidded down, that it can't go below the floor of the prevailing wage in the district. And the Republicans have wanted to blow it up ever since either 31 or 35 when it was passed, and they just did.
Yes, sir, they did.
That's my take on it.
And they're hurting the little guys that are the working class of America that are trying to earn a decent living.
That's exactly right. And what you're going to see is you're going to see wages in these areas falling through the floor. And ultimately this harms the small businesses and small employers who over the short term are going to say, hey, gee, we can stop paying, you know, $8-$9 an hour, which is the prevailing wage in Louisiana. We can start paying $6 an hour because there's people willing to work for that. Yeah, sure they can. But then you're going to have everybody only earning $6 an hour. Where are they going to get the money to buy the goods from these local companies? And all of a sudden there's going to be a loss of demand for goods and services. And you're going to see a depression in the local areas. I mean, the economy is either spiraling down or spiraling up. You take out the prop of Davis-Bacon in a local community, and you're going to destroy that local economy, which is, you know, just fine for the cons. Just fine for the cons. Greg, thanks a lot for the call. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program, where our talking points come from Jefferson and Madison, not the RNC.
Democracy to the United States of America. Here's Tom Hartman.
There's something wrong with the world today. I don't know what it is.
It's Republicans.
Something's wrong with our eyes.
It's the media. Welcome back, my friends. 34 and a half minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. 1-866-889-8894. Telephone number if you'd like to drop into our live chat room. Go to TomHartman.com. The so-called Progress for America, the reinvention of the swift boat folks, are creating a phony straw man argument saying that John Roberts should refuse to answer the questions of the United States Senate, as he is doing this morning, because that would force him to prejudge cases. Nonsense. No one is saying that Roberts should be telling us how he would vote on a case that comes before the court. That's a whole different thing from saying what his opinions are on specific topics. What they've done, what this so-called Progress for America, this right-wing group, the so-called which has ripped off the name of the Center for American Progress in the finest swift boat tradition. What this Progress for America group has done with this video, which is playing all over the United States, carpet bombing the United States to change people's opinions of this, is selectively edited Ruth Bader Ginsburg's testimony, implying that she refused to answer senators' questions on a lot of important topics. It also ignores the fact that over 13 years she was a federal judge and she had over 700 opinions. They had a very clear record. They knew exactly where she stood. Here's the real Ginsburg precedent. When Pat Leahy, Democrat from Vermont, the senator, asked Ruth Bader Ginsburg, is there a right to privacy in the Constitution? Now, you're going to hear Roberts dance all over this thing. Ruth Bader Ginsburg said, and I quote, there is a constitutional right to privacy composed of at least two distinguishable parts. One is the privacy expressed most vividly in the Fourth Amendment. The government shall not break into my home or my office without a warrant based on probable cause. The government shall leave me alone. The other is the notion of personal autonomy. The government shall not make my decisions for me. I shall make as an individual, uncontrolled by my government, basic decisions that affect my life's course. So Hank Brown, Republican from Colorado, asks her about the woman's right to choose for an abortion. And Ruth Bader Ginsburg says, and I quote, you asked me about my thinking about equal protection versus individual autonomy. My answer to you is that both are implicated. The decision whether or not to bear a child is central to a woman's life, to her well-being and dignity. It is a decision she must make for herself. When government controls that decision for her, she is being treated as less than a fully adult human responsible for her own choices. That is what Ginsburg actually said. She didn't duck the question. She answered the question. I mean, that's a verbatim quote. But no, the Swift Boat Veterans Progress for America liars would have you think it's something very different than that. And then we've got John Roberts coming along and saying that he can't find rights defined in the Constitution. You know, if you want a right, pass a law. I mean, here it is. This Scalia saying the same thing. I mean, this is a movement. You have to understand the Federalist Society, the Republican Lawyers Association. This is a movement to change the fundamental relationship between us and our government in the United States. When the Constitution was first put together in 1787, James Madison was the unofficial guy who ran the Constitutional Convention. He had spent 5 years studying the convention, the constitutions of countries all over the world, and the history of constitutions. He was the guy. He kept the diary that was secret for 50 years. It's now in print. It was because the whole thing was done behind closed doors, behind locked doors, in secret. Because in many ways, the Constitution of the United States worked against the interests of the most wealthy and powerful in America. And it was a hard sell. And so anyhow, he put together the Constitution, and he sends this Constitution to Jefferson, who was his mentor. And Jefferson at that time was living in Paris. He was the U.S. envoy to Paris, the equivalent of the ambassador to Paris, 1787. And Jefferson reads it and sends him back a letter saying, you know, I like this, and I like this, and I like this, but now I will tell you what I do not like. And Jefferson just lays it out. He says, what I do not like is that this Constitution does not provide without the aid of sophistry or legal argument, or legal, I forget the exact phrase, sophistry and legal whatever, a specific bill of rights that no government shall ever be allowed to violate. And then he goes through his list of the Bill of Rights, and there were 10 of them in there, including that there should not be a standing army during times of peace, which is what the Second Amendment is a fragment of. It's a whole other discussion for some other time. And that there should not be allowed monopolies in commerce. A ban on monopolies in commerce. In other words, corporations cannot own other corporations. He didn't want to see these huge, you know, dynasties, corporate dynasties that we have today. Madison responded to him and said, okay, the corporate dominance, every state has a law against that, so you don't have to worry about that, which was true. And then they had a long battle about the standing army, and as I said, that's a whole other discussion. But anyhow, Madison writes him back and says, well, you know, we really don't need to have a Bill of Rights in the Constitution, because the Constitution is a Bill of Rights. And in fact, Alexander Hamilton, who was a conservative, he was, you know, he and Madison and Jefferson were on very different sides of a lot of arguments, but Hamilton and Madison, political foes, got together to peddle the Constitution, and this was the Federalist Papers, and in Federalist number 84, Hamilton, arguing against a Bill of Rights in the Constitution, says, I go further and affirm that a Bill of Rights is not only unnecessary in the proposed Constitution, but would even be dangerous. Now, why would Hamilton think a Bill of Rights would be dangerous? He says, because people may think that these are the only rights they have. People might mistakenly think that we're giving, that the Constitution gives us rights. It doesn't. We hold the rights. And occasionally we will get together and we will say, you know, we're going to take away some of our own rights. We're going to collectively agree to take away our right to drive through a red light. Because there's a public good that will serve each one of us if we take away that right. So I no longer have a right to drive through a red light, but I don't get killed. That seems like a reasonable trade-out. So anyhow, Hamilton says, for why declare that things shall not be done when there's no power to do? For why, for instance, should it be said that the liberty of the press should not be restrained when no power is given by which restrictions may be imposed? In other words, what he's saying is that the Constitution, the government, doesn't have the right to give rights, doesn't have the power to give rights. The rights are held by we the people. The first three words of the Constitution, we the people of the United States. We hold the rights. And the government has only privileges, and it doesn't delegate rights to us. In fact, Hamilton says, if you attach a Bill of Rights to the Constitution, it is evident that it would furnish to men disposed to usurp a plausible pretense for claiming that power. The truth is, I'm reading from Federalist 84, after all the declamation we have heard that the Constitution is itself in every rational sense and every useful purpose, a Bill of Rights. So Jefferson writes back to Madison, hearing Hamilton's argument and Madison's argument, and he says, yeah, I agree with you. You and I know that. We all, everybody in the generation of 1776, the revolutionary generation, we all understand that we, the people, hold the rights and the government has no rights. It only has privileges. But future generations may forget. And if those future generations forget, we have to embed in the Constitution right now the absolute minimum necessary rights for a democracy, a democratic republic, to continue to function. Because if we fail to do that, and they forget, we may devolve into tyranny. And so let's at least define that the right of the freedom of the press shall not be infringed, that the right of people to peaceably assemble and petition their government for redress of grievances shall not be abridged. In other words, you can't have free speech zones where you herd people off at gunpoint. That the right of privacy shall not be abridged. That the right to a trial, that if you're arrested, that within a short and reasonable time, you have the right to be faced with your accuser and charged with a crime, to have counsel, to be represented by an attorney, and to have a trial before a jury of your peers. That these core rights, that, by the way, Bush has taken apart, that these core rights shall never be violated. Because future generations may forget that the Constitution doesn't give rights. That we hold the rights. The Constitution limits rights from, and basically limits the powers of government. So Madison writes him back and says, okay, how about a compromise? We'll put in those rights that you want in the first eight amendments to the Constitution, and then we'll add two more that say, and by the way, we don't mean to say with these first eight amendments to the Constitution that we're giving rights to people. In fact, in the Ninth and Tenth Amendments, you'll read all the rights that are not defined in this. It doesn't mean that they don't belong to the people, and it doesn't mean that they don't belong to the states. The states and the people still have all those rights. And Jefferson at that point says, cool, let's do it. And they finally even got Alexander Hamilton on board. And in 1789, bang, the Constitution gets ratified, the Bill of Rights gets attached to it. And now you've got Scalia coming along saying, and I quote, abortion, gay rights, the right to die, these are best left to the legislative and executive branches. You want a right to abortion? Pass a law. In other words, Scalia is saying the only way you can have a right is if there's a law that says you have a right. I got to tell you where this is going. These guys are saying you don't have the right to determine if you're going to have an abortion or not. If that stands, and you don't have the right to determine whether or not you can have birth control, what's to stop them from using the exact same legal argument from saying you don't have the right to have a second child? If we're giving up our rights to reproductive freedom, then can the government come in and say, hey, you don't have a right to have a second child. We're going to a one-child policy just like China. How far away are we from joining the communist dictatorship of China? 45 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Heard newborn babies wailing like a moaning dove. And old men with broken teeth stranded without love. Do I understand your question, man? Is it hopeless and forlorn? Come in, she said, I'll give you shelter from the storm.
And welcome back. 9.5 minutes before the hour, 50 or 50 and a half minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number, tomhartman.com, the website if you want to drop into our live chat room. Amy in San Diego, California on the line. Hey, Amy, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. I just wanted to ask, why do conservatives only object to activist judges when they're expanding people's rights like civil rights or Roe v. Wade or same-sex marriage? Why aren't they outraged when the Supreme Court declared, you know, corporations are people or money to be speech? Why doesn't that bother them?
Because the fundamental conservative worldview is essentially one of plutocracy, of aristocracy, of oligarchy, of a small number of very powerful, very wealthy people ruling the rest of us and putting a thin veneer, the appearance of democracy, on the surface of it. And it's been, I mean, it's been pretty overt about this from Sir Edmund Burke through Russell Kirk's brilliant book in 1951. I think he wrote it, maybe it was 53, called The Conservative Mind, that Barry Goldwater quoted and was a seminal document for William F. Buckley Jr. and, you know, just animated him. And they just lay it right out. I mean, Edmund Burke back in 1796, 1797, something like that, right after the French Revolution. Thomas Paine went from the United States over to England and spent a couple of weeks staying at the home of Sir Edmund Burke, who was the most articulate and leading spokesman for the conservative worldview in the world. And Paine at that time was the most articulate and outspoken proponent of the what today would be called a liberal worldview in the world. And they started this argument that continued in correspondence. And in one of the letters, Burke says to Paine, he says, "It does me no harm if a man is allowed to engage in as servile a profession as that of hairdresser or tallow maker, a candle maker. Yeah. However, it does society considerable violence if such a man is allowed to participate in public governance." In other words, to vote. And that's the conservative worldview. And, you know, they dress it up to try and make it sound like it's populist, but it's not. And the truth is that it's not because they're evil people. It's because they really and truly believe that that's the best way to have a stable government. That, you know, John Adams said it over and over and over again, that you can't trust the rabble.
Yeah, right? Exactly.
It's why they didn't allow that. This was the big battle that Adams and Hamilton were on one side of and Madison and Jefferson on the other of whether or not the Senate should be elected by we the people. And what they decided was that the people can elect the House of Commons, the Congress, the House of Representatives, but the people cannot elect the United States Senate. And we didn't start electing United States senators here in the United States until, I believe it was 1917. It might have been 1913, but it was right in the 19-teens there. I think it was the 17th Amendment in 1913, as I recall.
Wow.
And it's because that's the conservative worldview. Amy, thanks for the call.
Thanks, Tom.
Good to hear from you. You have to understand what their thinking is and how they will deceive, how they will, you know, lie to us to put out that worldview and get it out there so that people can get it. Logan in Manhattan. Hey, Logan, what's up?
Hey, what's up, Tom? I was wondering why everybody's under the delusion that the Republicans have this sway over the majority of Americans. It just seems like they don't have a majority by any means. And why is it that the Democrats keep going after the Republican voters?
What do you mean?
Well, it seems like the Democrats in office are always trying to appeal to the center right.
Oh, well, I'll tell you what's going on is you've got the Democratic Leadership Council out there. What happened was in the late 1980s, early 1990s, the Democrats were watching as the 20-year, at that time, 15-year war on organized labor was having some success. When Ronald Reagan came into office, a quarter of America's workforce was unionized. Today, it's like 9% of our private workforce is unionized. About 12% of the total workforce, if you include government employees. When Reagan came in, it was a quarter of our workers. For every good union job, there's another equivalent job in terms of pay and benefits in the economy. So half of Americans, when Reagan came into office, were able to raise their family, put their kids through school, have all their medical expenses covered, have a pension, have a retirement, the whole bit, right? Reagan declared war on organized labor and just started kicking out all the props that supported it, the Davis Act and all these other things, and he was quite successful. He was stripping apart the unions. And so Clinton comes along and he says, okay, we can't depend on unions for money anymore. Traditionally, the unions have been a big source of Democratic money. The Republicans have been getting their money from corporations. Where can we get money from? And he looked around and he says, let's get our money from the corporations. So he invented this whole thing of the New Democrats, the Democratic Leadership Council, and basically they're, for lack of a better word, prostitutes. I mean, they're Republican light. And they went out and they said to the corporations, we'll do your bidding. We'll pass NAFTA. We'll pass GATT. We'll make it very, very comfortable for you if you'll give us money. And it wasn't until Howard Dean came along that we realized that we didn't need to do that. We could raise money on the Internet.
Well, can you specify though what NAFTA and GATT allowed for that didn't allow for before that?
Sure. What they did, because they're treaties in large part, what they did was they surrendered the sovereignty of the United States. Article 6 of the Constitution says that if we sign a treaty, that becomes the law of the land. If we sign a treaty with Mexico that says every time the word Mexico is used in the United States, people have to jump to their feet, click their heels, and sing Hail Mexico, that actually is the law of the land, and you can go to jail for not doing it. So when we signed these treaties that involved many of these trade agreements, we put multinational corporations in charge of our own laws. So, for example, we had passed a law, we had passed laws going back, you know, way back to protect, for example, the tuna, when you catch tuna, to protect the dolphins that swim above seas of groups of tuna. And after we passed NAFTA, Mexico comes in and says, you can't do that. That's illegal restraint of trade. We passed those laws in the United States. Mexico, actually multinational corporations based in Mexico, forced us to repeal them under Article 13, I believe it was, or Article 11 of NAFTA. We surrendered that sovereignty. But I digress. I mean, let's I want to get back to John Roberts. Thanks for the call, Logan. Good to hear from you. But, you know, this is John Roberts, by the way, is all in favor of this. He's another one of these corporations should have rights. Let's surrender our sovereignty to them. Why? Because it makes for a stable society. Keep in mind, Hitler was all about 1,000 years of peace as well. And you say, oh no, there goes the hyperbole. But be very careful when anybody comes along and says, oh, our little group knows how to guarantee peace and security forever. We need to be giving the power to we the people, not a small conservative elite.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. For a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you. Our telephone number, 1-866-889-8894. TomHartman.com if you want to drop into our live chat room. Steve, a truck driver in Virginia on the line. Hey, Steve, what's up?
Hey, Tom, how you doing? It's the first time I've listened to you. I just got Sirius Radio, first time I've heard you.
Well, I'm glad you have.
Well, I'm a Republican, so you probably are. But there is no right to privacy in the Constitution.
You know why that is, Steve?
It don't exist.
You know why that is, Steve?
No government can guarantee a right to privacy.
You know why that is, Steve?
Because no government can guarantee the right to privacy.
No. The word privacy doesn't exist in the Constitution because in 1787 the word privacy meant I need to use the toilet. It wasn't until Thomas Crapper invented the flush toilet that we started referring to privacy as something other than toilet functions. Back then, toilets referred to as privies. Outhouses were called privies. If you said I need a moment of privacy, you meant I need to use the toilet.
But it's not even implied in the Constitution.
I'm sorry?
I mean, it's not even implied.
It's not even implied?
No, it's not even implied in the Constitution.
Have you read the Fourth Amendment?
You cannot commit a crime and hide behind privacy or whatever they called it back then. You cannot do it. So how does, abortion falling under privacy rights?
The Fourth Amendment says, the Fourth Amendment very, very explicitly, just lays it right out. Unambiguously, the Fourth Amendment of the Constitution, the right of the people to be secure in their persons. right? That is the right to buy. Houses, papers, and effects against unreasonable searches and seizures shall not be violated, and no warrants shall be issued but upon probable cause supported by oath or affirmation and particularly describing the place to be searched and the persons and things to be seized. It says the right of persons shall not be violated. It's very simple. The right of privacy is right there. They just didn't use the word privacy, Steve.
How does that include abortion?
If you
a crime, you can't do it behind your closed doors. You can't murder behind closed doors. You can't steal behind closed doors.
Right, and as a society, we get together and we decide what those things are that we're going to limit people from doing. Stephen, we're going way far afield here on this, and I'm not gonna travel down that road. David Orr is with us with Oberlin University. David is I just lost my page here. David is a distinguished professor of environmental studies at Oberlin and chair of its environmental studies program. This is our Bioneers moment, by the way. Founded in 1990, Bioneers is a nonprofit organization that promotes practical environmental solutions and innovative social designs for restoring the earth. Hey, David, welcome.
Tom, thanks.
Tell us about Bioneers.org is the website, and I'll be speaking at the Bioneers Conference this year, as I assume you will be as well.
I am.
And you've been writing about ecological design.
I have been, and been involved in architectural design and building high-performance buildings, and buildings that are powered by sunlight, use no toxic products, recycle their own waste, and so design means a lot of things, but in architectural sense, it means high-performance buildings.
So at what point, or how close are we, in a real practical sense, to ecological design being a practical reality?
Oh, I think it's here, and I think if you begin to add the cost of, say, Katrina or mountaintop removal in West Virginia, if you add the real cost of bad design, the time is long since come that we ought to be designing better buildings, better farms, better systems, and a good bit of the damage to Katrina is the result of literally decades of bad management of the New Orleans environments in the lower Mississippi Valley.
As are you talking about the development of the coastal wetlands that were the buffer for the storm surges?
Oh, sure. Yeah, I mean, oil development down there, the destruction of mangrove forests that were a buffer for storms, that's the way nature designed. I mean, that is intelligent design. Nature designed the coastal areas so that they were buffered from storms and storm surges. And we've paid a high price for some pretty bad decisions over a lot of years.
So what you said, knowledge carries with it the responsibility to see that it's well used in the world. What do you mean by this?
Well, I think it's kind of an abstract point, but it means that when you learn something, when the academy or when colleges and universities produce knowledge, we're responsible for that. And for example, no knowledge has probably ever done more damage, in my judgment, to the larger prospects of the world than economics knowledge that led us to a free trade world and the World Trade Organization. And yet that passes as knowledge about what is taken to be the science of economics. In fact, it's been part of the pillaging of a lot of economies in a lot of parts of the world in the name of corporate power. So when we do things in the academy, it has consequences, and that's all that statement means.
Okay. And the ecological design revolution, where do we go with this?
Well, it's more than just architecture and engineering. I mentioned that first because that's what people think of when they think of design. But design is really the way we manage the human presence in the world and the way we make it, the way we make communities and farms and businesses and so forth. It's possible to put that at a profit and eliminate having to fight wars in Iraq for cheap energy.
So we could have a stronger economy, we could have a more profitable world, and as a consequence of this, not at the same time not be using as much fossil fuel.
Absolutely. And in the meantime, avoid the balance of payments problems, climate change issues, all the health problems associated with. But that's design. That's a matter of us connecting the dots and seeing patterns and systems. This isn't really rocket science.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. And you also in you have an article, Six Myths for the Foundation of Modern Education, Six New Principles to Replace Them. Those six myths are?
Well, the biggest myth is that, and this again is an abstract point, but the biggest myth is that ignorance is a solvable problem. And it really isn't. Ignorance is part of the human condition. And what that means is that when you apply that principle of the way we build things and the way we do things and back on design, it means you leave a margin of error. People in Europe call this the precautionary principle. This administration is trying to push us toward not only more oil use and more oil extraction, but toward nuclear power. And nuclear power, as you know, is a very expensive way to boil water. And one that is prone to acts of malfeasance or terrorism, acts of God. We've got a list of nuclear reactor accidents, but it's not the kind of thing that we ought to be doing when we have much better, much cheaper, and much smarter alternatives. So in this case, we really don't know what we're getting into. And that's one of the biggest myths of education, is we can simply solve all of these issues, that ignorance itself is solvable. And in fact, at some scale, it's just not. We don't really know a good bit about the effects of human actions.
So, very good. David Orr is the Distinguished Professor of Environmental Studies at Oberlin and Chair of its Environmental Studies Program. You can get more information about it at oberlin.edu. And the author of The Nature of Design, Earth and Mind, Ecological Literacy, and The Last Refuge. David, thank you for being with us today.
Tom, thank you.
Appreciate it much. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program. It is 15 minutes past the hour. Telephone number 1-866-889-8894. Just to get back to the semi-argument I was having with the caller at the beginning of the hour, he's again coming from the point of view that if the Constitution doesn't say that you have a right, then you don't have a right. And this is the dangerous mindset that Robert. Let's say for a moment that there is no right to privacy in the Constitution. Although if you go back and read Roe v. Wade, you find that it wasn't just turned on the Fourth Amendment. It was turned on the Fourth Amendment, on the 14th Amendment, equal protection under the law. There was a whole series of things that had to do with Roe v. Wade. But let's say for a moment that there is no right to privacy. That doesn't mean it doesn't exist. There's no right in the Constitution to get married. There's no right in the Constitution to have lunch. There's no right in the Constitution to have a job. There's no right in the Constitution to walk down the street. There's no right in the Constitution to travel. There's no, none of these things are in the Constitution because the Constitution doesn't give us rights. It's just that simple. We can get together and we can take away rights by consensus, by passing laws, but we don't give rights. The Constitution doesn't give us rights. It merely limits the powers of government. Very, very simple, very straightforward. Jerry in Wichita, Kansas. Hey, Jerry, what's up?
How you doing, Tom?
Good. We got about 30 seconds here, Jerry. I'm sorry.
All right. Very quickly, then, I will just say, for your argument, Thomas Jefferson said one time that those who would give up freedom for security will not, nor do they deserve, either one.
Yeah, actually, it was Ben Franklin who said that, but you're I believe.
All right.
But
well,
spot on. Close enough.
The whole point of it is and I think it was Thomas Jefferson, and it's what I got from my book. But nonetheless, I've used that because the problem...
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Today you're working for the man.
Welcome back, my friends. 21 minutes past the hour, 21 and a half minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Our telephone number, 866-889-8894. Website, tomhartman.com. It is the place where smart people get their news. Let's take a phone call here. It's Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Services with us. Hey, Victoria.
Well, hi, Tom.
What's going on in Washington, D.C. today?
Well, quite a lot. The president met with the president of Iraq today, and he's indicated that the mess after Katrina was kind of his fault, not the president of Iraq, but the president of the United States, which is unusual in itself. He will be addressing the nation tomorrow night at 9 Eastern, from Louisiana. There are cynics who would say that the Karl Rove spin machine is in full spin, and then there are some who would say that the president really wants to do this. Regardless, he's also off this afternoon to the United Nations, where he will later today meet with Kofi Annan. He's there for this big summit, and he'll host a reception tonight. However, that basically is all being eclipsed by the hearings of Judge John Roberts to be Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, which are going on today before the Senate Judiciary Committee. Quite frankly, every television in Washington is tuned to those.
Yeah, and am I correct in assuming that this thing is just going to spin right through the Roberts? Do you think anybody's going to ask Roberts about his role with Iran-Contra?
No, I doubt
the theft of the 1980 election and the giving the hostages to the Ayatollah and the whole thing.
No.
The Christian Science Monitor has reported on this. The headline, on Iran-Contra, what did Roberts know? Fascinating. Today's edition of the Christian Science Monitor.
Well, I mean, if it's as recent as today's edition, it occurs to me maybe in the second round of questioning something might come up about that. But the kind of person who was likely to do that today was Joseph Biden, and that was not the direction in which he chose to go. Biden really was the liveliest of the senators, as he usually is, but he wanted to get Roberts on this Ginsburg rule that Roberts said he was going to go by, which that he would answer the same kind of, under the same rules that Judge Ginsburg gave for herself, although why he should do that, I don't know. And Biden went to some length to show him that, in fact, he wasn't going by the Ginsburg rule, that when it suited him, he was going by the Ginsburg rule, and when it didn't suit him, he wasn't going by the Ginsburg rule, and when he didn't go by the Ginsburg rule, it was always in the case of not answering rather than answering.
Did it stick?
That's nothing you can do, is there? You've got Roberts sitting there and saying what he wants to say.
So Biden points this out, and Roberts just says, yep, tough.
Roberts doesn't concede that's basically that Biden was correct.
Yeah.
I mean, Roberts has to do as little as he has to do to get through, and I think Biden weakened himself by giving a lengthy, almost 7-minute speech at the beginning of his time. It
yeah.
wasn't necessary to do that, and it meant that there was less time for Roberts to possibly make a mistake.
Yeah, and is Roberts giving short answers, or is he filibustering with long, meaningless answers?
Very occasionally he's filibustering. I mean, Biden accused him of filibustering, but it was a bit of a harsh judgment because actually what it was he wasn't giving the answer that Biden wanted. But mostly he's giving fairly short answers, but he's also giving non-answer answers. So whether they're short or long, nobody's getting anywhere.
Right. Interesting. Okay, Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service. Thanks for the report, Victoria.
Thank you.
Good to hear from you. It's interesting to keep on track of this and see where this whole thing goes.
Condescending.
And now,
making money, selling lies.
Time for a Rush Alert.
Everybody hates my guts.
Hates his guts.
I'm offensive, I'm a bigot, I'm a fraud. Can you dig it? I'm a sexist, racist, homophobic, fat, pathetic guts.
And now we find the liberals doing what they always do, and I've told you this, they always try to give me 50 milligrams of Vicodin instead of the 80s.
I'm a Nazi. That's right.
I really am, because I'm a Nazi.
Rush Alert for the day, and here it is. It's just get this for a moment. It's,
if their worldview is that this is a welfare state, the government needs to protect us.
Now he's talking about Katrina, and the government needs to protect it. Yeah, it's called police. It's called an army. Rush, sorry. Anyhow, he continues.
The government needs to feed us. The government needs to transport us. The government will get
in case of an emergency. Yeah, we collectively get together and we collectively say, you know, we are going to take care of ourselves when we are harmed, when the weakest among us are vulnerable. We are going to take care. It's got something to do with this message from the Bible and the Quran and human decency. Yes, human decency, Rush.
Well, guess what? Government needs to build the levees. Government needs to make sure the levees are government.
Yeah, yeah. It sounds like a plan, actually.
Passing the buck all over the place.
Oh, so we should have Halliburton building the levees.
And accepting all the money that the government's sending into you.
Yes, Halliburton, yeah.
And then something like this happens, and then you start, you know, wringing your hands, or, oh, look how poor the population. Well, what do you expect when you have a welfare state mentality?
Excuse me. Most of the people who were evacuated, they may have been black, but they weren't on welfare. Most of them were employed. Rush. This is, I mean, the revelation of this, that the assumption that because somebody is below the poverty line means that they're on welfare. It's just absolutely mind-boggling. Absolutely mind-boggling. You know, what can you say? I mean, you just want to go, what planet are these people on? Have they never had contact with the rest of America? Do they live absolutely... Well, yeah, I mean, Limbaugh's a multimillionaire. Do they live so isolated? Or is it just the spin for their buddies? Or both? That could be. 27 and a half minutes past the hour.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
It's never too late to start all over again.
Yeah, no, all we got to do is take back the House, take back the Senate, take back the White House. Seems like a plan. Actually, I probably shouldn't say this, but if you look back over the history of this country, it seems like very often the things work out best when at least one of those three branches of government, or the four if you include the judiciary, is actually run by an opposition party. But we can have that discussion when we actually get an opposition party going. Yeah. No. It's not much too late to start again. Todd is with us. He's on the Bring 'Em Home bus tour, Cindy Sheehan's group. They're going through... Are you going through Pittsburgh today?
Hello.
Hey, Todd.
Well, this is Bill.
Oh, this is Bill. I'm sorry.
Yeah, Bill, Todd gave me the phone. This is Bill sitting here talking to you.
Okay. Bill's with the Bring 'Em Home bus tour. Are you guys in Philadelphia or in Pittsburgh?
No, we are in Pittsburgh.
You're in Pittsburgh. Okay, great.
It's the third day here. And
we're on WPTT there, so there's folks in Pittsburgh listening to you right now.
Great, great. Welcome. Showing. We had a rally the first night in Pittsburgh. We had 1,000 people show up. It's been our largest rally yet.
That's fabulous.
I think it's building momentum. Every city that we've been into has buses organized going to D.C.
Yeah.
In fact, one of the local organizers here from the Thomas Merton Center has come out. They've got a financier who is picking up the tab in the buses, and so people in Pittsburgh can ride for free.
That's great. To Washington, D.C., you mean?
For September 24th, the mass mobilization being put together by United for Peace and Justice.
That's great. And what are you doing tonight in Pittsburgh?
You know what? I don't know what the schedule. I haven't looked at the schedule yet today. We have an event at 6:30, I know, tonight.
Okay, but you can't tell our listeners what it is or where it is because you're not sure?
You know, I bet if they go to our website, bringthemhomenowtour.org,
okay,
it'll have it.
Okay.
Anyway, we just finished doing a program here at the United Steelworkers of America, an AFL-CIO affiliate, and it was a nice turnout here, union people, and what we see happening is Americans from all walks of life are pulling together.
That's great.
We know the polls are showing now that the majority of Americans are indeed against this war, and I think Katrina should have brought that to every home in America, that our National Guard troops should be there protecting our nation.
Yeah, well said, Bill. Bill, what's the website one more time for people to get more information?
The website is bringthemhomenowtour.org.
Great. Bringthemhometour.org. Thanks a lot, Bill, for being with us. I appreciate it. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. Cindy in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Hey, Cindy.
Hi, I didn't expect to talk with you. I just wanted some information on how to get the lyrics to the one of the lullaby that Laura is supposedly have sung to George about. Papa's gonna buy you a diamond ring.
Oh, I don't know. I don't know.
You didn't hear it?
I'm sorry. No, I haven't. I haven't. You know,
it was on your show.
It was?
Yeah.
Huh.
Well, anyway, I firmly believe that if we don't get the message out, and the way to get the message out is the stage or music, one of the two, because people don't. I have to admit to have been a Stepford wife, and when I was teaching and I was having four kids and running the house and everything, I didn't even read the newspaper, and I hated history.
Yeah.
Now I'm reading all the history I can find, particularly your book about the ancient sunshine. It's
okay.
Terrific.
Well,
I'm almost finished with it.
Well, thank you very much,
I got your next
Cindy.
One ordered.
Great.
But how do I find, and you had another one a couple of days, maybe it was last week, a Western thing that was done. It was really terrific.
I think
that if we push that...
BillJacobs.us is one of the sources of our music, and many of them, I'm not exactly sure. Here's Jim Turr. This is from Blue Canyon Productions. impressions.com. His Laura Bush impression.
When I was just a little girl, I knew I'd marry a president.
Oh, yeah, she knew.
I had a song then going through my head, no idea what it meant. Get Saddam, Saddam.
Oh, yes.
I felt that would be the key to national unity.
Just get Saddam.
Saddam. We beat him not just once, but twice.
Well, okay, I think you get the point. Anyhow, you can find that at Blue Canyon Satire or BlueCanyonProductions.com, either website, both websites. Jim Turr runs them out of Santa Fe, New Mexico. Casey in Seattle, Washington on the line. Hey, Casey, welcome to the program.
Hey, thank you very much. I was just calling really quick to say, until about 3 weeks ago, I didn't know anything about politics at all. I'm studying history, basically like civil rights or the lack thereof for Black Americans.
Mm-hmm.
And somebody gave me the Fahrenheit 9/11 movie, so I watched that. And so, of course, the whole first part, I was like, what? You're kidding. So I'm like, no. I mean, my mouth hit the floor, and I started to cry because I was just like, you're joking. I mean, it just went with everything that I was reading, you know, Reconstruction, 1860s. So I'm telling everybody at work I need a crash course in politics, and I'm flipping through the radio station the next day about 3 weeks ago for Radio Disney for my son. And then I came across 1090, which is the station for Air America here.
In Seattle, yeah.
Oh, my gosh. I had no idea.
Isn't it great?
I had no idea.
Well, Casey, thank you very much for calling and for your kind appreciation.
I just wanted to thank you all so much, because if I didn't have that as like a resource, and I go to the library and I look up things every day, and I just wanted to thank you all so much, because I completely would have been in the dark. So
great.
I've told everybody, especially my generation, I'm like, no, we have to pay attention. You will not believe what's going on. So I just want to thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Casey. That's very kind of you, and I appreciate your comments. You can find a lot more information on both the Air America website, airamericaradio.com, and on my website, tomhartman.com. And however you spell it will get you there. And if you go to tomhartman.com, click on Articles on Democracy. I think you'll find some very useful stuff there. Justin in Norman, Oklahoma on the line. Hey, Justin, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Tom. I just wanted to say, first of all, I'm a big podcaster now. I love the podcast. And for anyone out there, you don't have to have an iPod to listen to it. And there's a great repository of information there that you can listen to 24 hours a day.
Mm-hmm. You mean over at the WhiteRoseSociety.org?
Yeah, I subscribe to them. And then also, if you just download iTunes, there's also other lectures on democracy and various things like
mm-hmm.
that and everything. What I was calling about is this weekend we went to help a local community church with some of the relief efforts. And this is in the Oklahoma City area. And I believe that they've dealt with about 2,000 families now. And so we just kind of asked them out of curiosity when we were looking at things to bring, you know, if the families had received their $2,000 credit card we keep hearing about. And, of course, I heard that on the podcast yesterday. There was a guy from a competitive institute, that brought that up right at the end.
Mm-hmm.
And the gentleman that worked for this church was saying, don't even ask me about that. You know, the families they've helped, about 2,000, none of them have really been able to get any kind of federal relief in this area or anything like that.
Yeah, I think I may be wrong on this, but my understanding was that they were passing out these $2,000 debit cards in Texas.
Yeah, I think
at the Astrodome
the only area.
And then, I think it's just limited to Bushville.
And then one of the other sad things is I hear a lot of people in the community, like in the Yukon area around here, saying that a lot of residents are worried about crime rates going up with these people coming in. I'm just thinking that's the saddest thing. And one of the other saddest things I actually heard actually came from my mother, and I'm really embarrassed, but she said that the only reason those poor people stay down there is because they knew they could get their checks at the first of the month. So I think as Americans, we really need to come together and realize the class warfare that's going on right now. And I think as Democrats, we really need to outreach to these poor people and say, look, you're being left behind. You know, it's just, I don't know, it's really sad. I mean,
well, and this is a good point, Justin, and thank you for that. This is also, you know, this is the stepping off point for Limbaugh's whole rant, which I'm getting now at least a half a dozen times every day in emails from various right-wing websites and commentators who are, you know, trying to influence opinion and sending them out and talking points for right-wing talk shows. And that is that it's all the welfare state. It's all the welfare state. And the welfare state is the evil thing. And the reality is that Ben Franklin, when he visited England in the early 1700s, like in the 1730s, as I recall, keep in mind, Ben Franklin was an old man when they did the Constitution. Maybe it was the 1750s, but anyhow, whenever it was, Ben Franklin went over to England, and he wrote back a long rant about the welfare society that he saw there, and how horrible it was, that the people were locked into poverty by being on the government dole. And he was right. And the problem was that there was no ladder out. In other words, what the government had done was it had created a cheap workforce in the slums, but there was no way to get out of that. There was no opportunity to step into the middle class. And what Lyndon Johnson did with the Great Society programs and the War on Poverty was he said, okay, we're going to take care of you for a generation. You know, in other words, you've got kids to raise, but we're going to give your children an opportunity, and you, for that matter, if you can, give you an opportunity to step out of poverty by providing grants to go to college, by providing good you know, public schools, by desegregating the schools, all these kinds of things. And from the 1960s until the mid-1980s, we saw an explosion in the number of people who moved out of the black poor class, which was the result of 200 years of institutionalized racism and essentially slavery and apartheid, who moved out of the black poor class into the black middle class. And then Reagan came along in the 1980s and started deconstructing those programs. And we've had the war on welfare and Bill Clinton coming along and saying, we're going to end welfare as we know it. And what they've done is they've created another self-fulfilling prophecy. It's just like you destroy FEMA and then you sit around when FEMA doesn't work and you say, see, it doesn't work. You destroy those programs that actually take people out of poverty and move them into the middle class. And what you end up with is the small remnant of them that actually, like Ben Franklin pointed out, will keep people in poverty. I mean, it's like there's always a little kernel of truth to what the conservatives are saying, but then they twist it around into the big lie. And it's so tragic because it's damaging and destroying the lives of so many Americans.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
You may be an ambassador to England or France. You may like to gamble. You might like to dance.
Who are you going to serve, my friend?
You may be the heavyweight champion of the world. You may be a socialite with a long string of pearls. But you're going to have to serve some.
Yes, indeed. And, you know, of course, when Bob wrote that song, he had a very specific religious theme in mind, but I think that there's some other ones now. For example, are you serving the Reich, or are you serving we the people? It seems like a fairly reasonable question. Time will tell. Time will tell. Judge Roberts, before Joe Biden today, this is one of those truly strange moments. Go ahead and continue not to answer, Senator Joe Biden of Delaware told the nominee at one point. Later, Biden interrupted Roberts and, when criticized, said, his answers are misleading with all due respect. Arlen Specter jumps in. Wait a minute. They may be misleading, but they are his answers. Yes. Oh, boy. In fact, David Brooks, the right-wing columnist for the New York Times, has revealed that from day one, this is from MediaMatters.org, from day one, the Bush White House decided our public relations is not going to be honest. Yes, that's a quote. Decided our public relations is not going to be amazing. This was the September 11th edition of the Chris Matthews Show. And David Brooks revealed that he had learned from private conversations with Bush officials who represent what Bush believes. Quoting David Brooks, they're tantamount to an admission of a major mistake. Now, it's going to be really interesting to see if this changes. Bush coming out today saying, I'm the guy responsible. That's a refreshing change. Is he going to say that he's the guy responsible for the screw-up in Iraq and all the dead Americans as a result of it? Is he going to say that he's the guy responsible for charging us into an invasion that was unnecessary? Is he going to say that he's the guy responsible for cooking the books and whether he, you know, which of the right-wing talking points he tries to insert? Because he, to the best of my knowledge, has never given a speech that wasn't deeply and intentionally deceptive. And how, you know, what kind of deception is he going to build into this one? For example, the Washington Post, September 4th, 05. Headline, White House shifts blame to state and local officials. When, in fact, this from a White House memo on the 27th of August, the 27th, as Hurricane Katrina is bearing down on New Orleans, quote from the White House, specifically FEMA is authorized to identify, mobilize, and provide at its discretion equipment and resources necessary to alleviate the impacts of the emergency. From the Wall Street Journal. Mr. Chertoff activated the National Response Plan last Tuesday by declaring the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina an incident of national significance. The plan, which was rolled out to much fanfare in January, essentially enables Washington to move federal assets to the disaster without waiting for requests from state officials. And then, of course, George Bush on September 1st goes on ABC's Good Morning America. He says, I don't think anybody anticipated the breach of the levees. I think you know that this has been gone over and over and over again. And you had Max Mayfield, the meteorologist, the federal, you know, the storm center guy, briefing George W. Bush on this. Briefing him before Katrina hit. Saying, you know, here's it. You're going to have storm surges. You're going to have destruction of buildings. You're going to have a major emergency in your hand. What does Bush do? He goes on vacation. Well, he stays on vacation. He goes to bed. So we're going to have to pay some careful attention here to what's going to go on, how this is going to play out, what he's going to do, how he's going to do it. With regard to the National Guard, this from the Washington Post. In Louisiana, Mississippi, civilian and military leaders said the response to the hurricane was delayed by the absence of the Mississippi National Guard's 155th Infantry Brigade and Louisiana's 256th Infantry Brigade, each with thousands of troops in Iraq. George W. Bush, no. In fact, Secretary Rice, Condi Rice, talking to Tavis Smiley, she says, no, it's not true. It's frankly hogwash. I'll use that term very, very clearly. Plenty of resources to deal with it. Where were they? Well, they were in Iraq. You know, it's Lieutenant General Stephen Bloom, the Bureau's chief. This is the National Guard Bureau. Had that brigade been at home, he says, and not in Iraq, their expertise and capabilities could have been brought to bear. End quote. On Hurricane Katrina. Could have been done. Could have been done. But, you know, we had to have a war in Iraq. Why did we have to have a war in Iraq? Because George W. Bush wanted to have political capital so the Republicans could take the Senate in 2000 and he could win in 2004.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Covers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you. The program where we dare to ask, is Walmart a person? And we dare to answer, no, don't think so. Definitely not, in fact. Clara Jeffrey is with us. Clara is the deputy editor at Mother Jones Magazine. Hey, Clara, welcome.
Hey, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Pleased to have you here. I'd like to drill down into this whole issue. You wrote an article, Sink or Swim, about the whole problem of Americans retiring broke, essentially. The American middle class really doesn't have enough savings set aside to deal with their retirement. And then we have all these strange laws that say, for example, that if you, I mean, this is the real death tax. If you get really sick, if you have Alzheimer's, if you have a long-term chronic condition and you need long-term care, you have to wipe out your savings and make yourself destitute before you qualify for Medicare in order to pay for those things. I mean, you talk about the real death tax. But you point out that Americans only save 1% of their disposable income a year, whereas Germans and Italians save 11%. Why would that be?
Well, you know, I think Americans are... Our optimists is one reason, and I think that they've come.
They're what?
They're optimists. I mean, I think they think that that tomorrow's never going to come, and it's going to, and when it does, everything's going to be all right. And in part, that's because we've had a good safety net in Social Security and some of the other federal programs that have, you know, in a couple generations managed to take the large chunk of the elderly out of poverty. It's Social Security is the only source of income for 1 in 5 elderly Americans.
Now, the 1% of our disposable income that Americans save, though, I would assume that a good chunk of that is saved through the vehicle of IRAs and 401ks and things like that. And I'm wondering, do the Germans and Italians have similar programs where the government encourages people to save? I know the Japanese do.
That's right. I mean, some European countries have similar savings accounts. I mean, there's also pension programs depending on the country, but they sort of save more money on their own, irregardless of what their governmental savings net looks like. And you know, I think that this has been a long trending issue in America that the savings rate has gone down and down and down, in part because people are living past their means and struggling, you know, in a two-parent household, or struggling with two or more jobs to keep up and to you know, keep their house and their kids in decent school. So,
which raises what I think is probably the larger issue, and that is that I remember, you know, I was born in the 1950s, and I remember growing up in the 50s and 60s that and in a blue-collar neighborhood where most of my friends' parents worked at Oldsmobile on the assembly line, and my dad worked in a tool and die shop, and with you know, a high school education and a good union job in Lansing, Michigan,
mm-hmm.
you could put your kids through college. You had health care throughout your whole entire life. You had a pension when you retired. I mean, my father's living on that pension right now.
Right.
And that was you know, a good solid middle class job. Ronald Reagan came along in 1980, declared war on organized labor. His trade policies and Bush's trade policies, and then Bill Clinton's really kicking the door open trade policies, began the evisceration of the American middle class. And in order to maintain that same standard of living, now pretty soon it took two people working, and now it's not even two people working can maintain that standard of living. And so what we're seeing is that the American dream is vanishing, whereas I would suggest, I lived in Germany for a year in 86, and you know, I visit there several times a year generally, and other parts of Europe as well, that middle class, what we call the American dream, is still alive and well in Germany and Italy. It is under assault from conservative forces, but it's still much more alive and well there. I mean, they're probably like we were in the early 80s. It's just beginning to be eroded. And don't you think that that's really the big variable here?
Yeah, I mean, I think that the sort of loss of the private pension, the corporate pension, as you mentioned, I mean, only 21% of the workforce now is covered by one, and that's a 23% decline since only 1988. And those pension plans that do still exist are often underfunded, are in big trouble, and even we see companies now that are even in good condition, that whose pension plan is in pretty good shape, dumping them basically because to keep up with their competitors, they want to, you know, to make cuts. So,
or even when they don't have competitors, just they, you know, like IBM, for example. Bernie Sanders went ballistic when they did this with the IBM plant in Vermont. That they're doing it because they simply want to enhance profit.
Exactly. I mean, only 20% of underfunded pensions are at companies considered to be financially weak. A lot of companies just don't properly fund their pensions, and then when they get in trouble, can cut them, and that enhances their own bottom line. I mean, it's very much the sort of shareholder-driven mentality.
So how do we change this?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, the SEC is looking into some of the illegality surrounding pensions, and I do really think there needs to be some major investigation into what the corporations are doing, because, you know, they're you know, of the S&P 500 companies, there's an estimated $1.13 trillion in off-balance sheet pension liabilities. In other words, they owe money, and they're not telling either their workers or their shareholders that they owe this. And this, again, leads to default. And I think there just needs to be a real tightening of the regulatory look at the way companies manage their pensions. You know, obviously we need to shore up Social Security, and that's, of course, a big debate in our country as to how much help it needs and what kind of help it should receive.
But Clara Jeffrey, deputy editor of Mother Jones Magazine, motherjones.com, the website, isn't there a larger picture here, which is that, you know, we're having these fights about, you know, it's almost, you know, about Social Security and about pensions and whether they should be funded and all this kind of thing. And it's almost a Lord of the Flies kind of battle. I mean, we're ignoring the world, the society around us, the world around us in which we have been shifted. That if we were to say, okay, we're no longer going to say that our trade agreements can be decided and defined by multinational corporations to the benefit of multinational corporations, but that if a company decides, you know, if you want to make a pair of shoes and it costs a dollar worth of labor to make that pair of shoes in the United States and it costs 10 cents worth of labor to make that pair of shoes in Malaysia, we're going to go back to the same kind of rules we had from 1787 when the first tariffs were passed up until the time Reagan started dismantling them and then, you know, Clinton finally did away with almost all of them. And we're going to go back to what built America over a 200-year period. We're going to say, that's fine, you can make those shoes in Malaysia, but when you bring them into the United States, you have to pay a 90-cent tax on them, an import tariff. And so it's going to cost you a dollar to make them in Malaysia, just as it's going to cost you a dollar to make them here. Because, I mean, basically ever since the end of the Civil War, when slavery ended, labor became just a commodity. And we have protected that commodity by saying that, you know, we want, there are certain industries that we want to keep in this country, and we're going to do it with tariffs. Why not just do away with these insane trade policies, bring our industries back to the United States, protect our domestic industries, and then you've got the good jobs again that can pay these pensions, and we can go back to being a, you know, a middle-class nation?
Well, you know, as much as we might wish for that to happen, I'm not sure that that's really realistic in the larger sense. But I think what we're both talking about is this sort of growing feeling. We saw it in New Orleans in a sort of sick way, is that, you know, it's every man for himself. The corporation isn't going to take care of you anymore. You know, Bush is trying to turn Social Security basically into a gift to Wall Street, these so-called personal accounts, which just minimizes government responsibility towards the elderly and the infirm.
Right, and then he wants to means test to turn it into a welfare program and
right.
Then slash it, because welfare programs can be slashed.
And it's this notion that, you know, that people can take care of themselves, and that's all well and good for people who are born with a silver spoon in their mouth or on third base, as the famous quote about George Bush goes. But,
yeah.
You know, I mean, I think that that's a real issue, and hopefully some of what's going to come out of this whole Hurricane Katrina thing is realizing what the larger picture of what's going on here, that we're sort of cutting into every government program that's about people taking care of their neighbors.
But see, the government programs can only exist if the government has enough revenue to fund them, and the government can only have enough revenue to fund them if we have a strong middle class. We, you know, it just seems to me like we need to be looking at the biggest picture first, which is how do you create an economy internally within a country that works? I mean, going back to Adam Smith 101, Smith said, you know, it's fine to have trade. In fact, it's a good thing if one country makes good cheese and another country makes good wine, and now you can both have wine and cheese. But if both countries make sweaters, then you don't want to trade in sweaters because you want to protect your domestic sweater industry.
Right, and I think what's so disturbing about what's going on is not only are we losing a lot of manufacturing jobs and pink-collar jobs, but by, you know, our education system just under assault, we're also not, as, you know, as everyone from Bill Gates to George Soros to conservatives are warning us, that we're not teaching engineers and doctors. We're not having the next generation of people that are going to lead those kind of
And this is rigidifying the class structure in the United States. It's a terrible thing. Clara Jeffrey, deputy editor of Mother Jones Magazine, motherjones.com. Thanks for being with us, Clara.
Thanks so much.
Thanks for writing this great piece, Sink
Thank
or Swim,
you.
By Clara Jeffrey. It's a Tom Hartman radio program, 17 minutes past the hour.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
Well, I've been howling in my sleep. I've been starring in my dream. All right.
And welcome back, my friends. I have been saying for a year and a half, at least, that people have been saying, oh, George Bush, he's going to declare war on Iran. And I've been saying, I think he's going to save that war for the 2008 elections. See, Bush knows that in order to have electoral success, in order for his party to win at the polls, he has to have a war. And so in 2002, he whips up the Iraq war, and he's in the middle of, you know, war hysteria as we're going into the election cycle. And that helped the Republicans take back the Senate. And then in 2004, he's got the war going full tilt boogie, and that helps get him reelected, if you accept the notion that all of the fraud in Ohio didn't actually happen. And I've been saying all along, his 2006 war, the 2006 Republican war, is not going to be Iran. That'll be the 2008 war. That's going to be a big war. That's going to be the one for 2008. His 2006 war is going to be Syria. And here we have today a story coming out of the Middle East. Khalilzad warns Damascus, we've run out of patience. Syria is the center of terrorists who would like to stop democratic processes in Iraq, and the U.S.'s patience on this issue has ended, according to U.S. Ambassador to Baghdad, Zalmay Khalilzad. Khalilzad, who escorted Iraqi President Jalal Talabani visiting Washington, said both the Americans and the Iraqis have run out of patience. And it's time for the Damascus administration to make its decision. Various options are on the table, he informed. Now, this at the same time that the Syrian ambassador to the United States keeps saying, hey, you want to talk? We're anytime, anywhere. Let's, you know, how can we help? Syria sharing intelligence with us after 9/11. Syria trying to work with us. The Bush administration beginning the vilification of Syria. Mark my words. See, Bush learned the lesson well of his mentor, Ronald Reagan. Have a war against a country that can't fight back. Invade Grenada. You don't take on a country that can, you know, there's a good chance you'll lose or a chance that you'll take a lot of losses. You don't do that. You go after, you know, Syria, you know, yeah, they got an army, sort of. They got a bit of an air force. They're not in as bad a shape as Iraq was. But it's a smaller country, too. And it's a poorer country. They don't have as much oil wealth. In fact, they have very little. So, Syria is next. Time will tell. I hope I'm wrong. But boy, does it sure seem like Syria is being set up here. Joanne in Monterey, California on the line. Hey, Joanne, welcome to the program.
Hi, yes. I have a comment about the rednecks who are worried that the black evacuees coming into Oklahoma are going to increase the crime rate.
Right.
And I actually am, well, probably not politically correct about this, but see, what's behind this is that the poor blacks are far more racially aware than poor whites. And this is due to the work of Martin Luther King and Malcolm X and others in the civil rights movement.
No, it's due to 200 years of oppression, slavery, lynchings, being drawn and quartered, being branded, being whipped in public. You know, being the servant of Strom Thurmond and raped at the age of 15, that's what it's due to.
Yeah, but I mean, their awareness, though, of this is due to Martin Luther King and people like Malcolm X.
Awareness of what?
Awareness that they have rights.
Oh, I
see.
Okay. Okay. Excuse me. I thought you meant their awareness of race. I'm sorry.
Yeah. Well, yeah. I mean, but that goes with it because they're the ones that were slaves. anyway, so the thing is this. As a result, blacks will steal from a poor white person before they will break into a poor black home.
I, you know, I'm sorry, Joanne. I'm just not going to go. You know, all these generalizations. Blacks will do this. Whites will do that. Come on. Give me a break. I'm sorry. It's just, you know, some of the most racist people I've ever met in my life have been white. Racism exists on both sides. But I'm just, you know, it's just not going to go there. Search teams found more than 40 bodies. The ongoing disaster, the ongoing absolute disaster in New Orleans. After George W. Bush had assured the governor, we're going to take care of this. After the governor declares a state of emergency, he contacts Bush. He says, okay, he declares a state of emergency. FEMA's on the job. Don't worry. And then Bush goes back on vacation. The ongoing disaster unfolding. Search teams found more than 40 bodies. Many of them elderly patients. Inside a hospital flooded out by Hurricane Katrina, officials said Monday. Many of the patients had died while waiting to be evacuated over the 4 days after the storm hit as temperatures inside Memorial Medical Center rose to 106 degrees, said David Goodson, assistant administrator of the hospital owned by Tenet Healthcare Corporation. He says none of the deaths resulted from lack of food, water, or electricity. Many of the patients were seriously ill. Tough situation. Now, at the same time, we have this story in the Daily Mail in the UK, we had to kill our patients. Doctors working in the hurricane-ravaged New Orleans killed critically ill patients rather than leaving them to die in agony as they evacuated hospitals. Is there a relationship between these two? I don't know. But I have a feeling there's a lot of very grim stories coming out of this thing. 28 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
When sundown pales the sky, I want to hide a while behind your smile, and everywhere I look, your eyes would find.
And welcome back, my friends. The GOP using Katrina to justify unrelated right-wing agenda, writes David Sirota. In the wake of Hurricane Katrina, yeah, guess what? Everything gets turned into an opportunity to advance the right-wing agenda. They've made a strategic decision, the Republican Party, to use the Katrina disaster to push their ideological agenda. From the bootstraps, who needs them? Theory of, we need a poor underclass, as say the cons. You've got to have a vast labor pool, right? Privatized Social Security. Congress Daily last week reported that the White House is using the disaster in the Gulf Coast to justify its scheme to privatize Social Security. Bush spokesman Trent Duffy asserted that the vast spending that would be required to address the hurricane's impact adds to the need to change Social Security, which threatens to strain the budget in coming years. Right. Now let me get this straight. Social Security is going to be in trouble because Reagan started borrowing from the Social Security Trust Fund, and then Bush continued that, and then Clinton continued that for at least 6 out of his 8 years, and then Bush continued that big time, and we've borrowed all this money from the Social Security Trust Fund, so Social Security is going to be in trouble. So the solution is to borrow another $1 trillion and use that to privatize it? Because of Katrina? Well, according to Bush spokesman Trent Duffy, sure enough. New York Times last week, quote, this is another, you know, let's move the Reich's agenda along. Republican leaders in Congress and some White House officials see opportunities in Hurricane Katrina to advance long-standing conservative goals like giving students vouchers to pay for private schools and paying churches to help with temporary housing. James Madison's first veto was a veto of a bill that would have given money to a church in Washington, D.C. to care for the poor. And he vetoed that bill because he was of the opinion that when government started giving money to churches, the corruption of the churches themselves would not be far behind. Pretty soon the churches would start engaging themselves in politics, and the preachers would be up on the pulpit talking about politics instead of talking about religion. And in Madison's mind, Madison, who was a fairly, I don't know what the word is, God-fearing Christian, whatever you want to call it, Madison was concerned that his religion was going to get corrupted by money from government. And so he vetoed that bill. He believed, you know, Jesus' old dictum, render unto Caesar what is Caesar's and unto God what is God's, was absolute, that the separation of church and state, in his mind, had been created by the founder of Christianity. And arguably, even back before that, you know, in the Old Testament, when the Jews said, no, you know, okay, no more kings. The minimum wage. Reuters reports that last week President Bush signed an executive order suspending the Davis-Bacon Act in the Gulf Coast. We started out the program mentioning this briefly. The Davis-Bacon Act says that if the government is going to come into an area and spend money, particularly in the case of a disaster, you have to pay the prevailing wage. In other words, if because you don't want to disrupt the local economy. If the government comes in and just starts hiring people willy-nilly, it's gonna have a disruptive influence on the local economy. So we're going to maintain a certain wage floor, that floor being the prevailing wage. So if a community has an average wage of $8 an hour, or an average wage of $7 an hour, average wage of $9 an hour, that's what the government has to pay. That's the Davis-Bacon Act. The prevailing wage, by the way, is usually in the neighborhood of the union wages. Well, not usually. It depends on the community. It depends on the state, too. But now that they've suspended Davis-Bacon, big contractors, Halliburton, Bechtel, they can come in and they, oh, yeah, we'll do the cleanup, we'll take care of it, and we'll pay $5.25 an hour. And all you have to do is go into that toxic waste dump there. Are we going to have people falling over, dropping dead down the road, just like they did after helping clean up in New York City, the disaster in New York City? May well be. The GOP using Katrina to justify more giveaways to the oil industry. Now here you've got an industry that got, what, 11, 12, 13, depending on how you figure it, $1 billion in tax breaks and giveaways from the federal government in the energy bill that Dick Cheney helped put together. The energy bill that, basically they throw a bone to solar and renewables, but basically does nothing other than promote the interests of the oil industry, the gas industry, the coal industry, and the nuclear industry. The friends of this administration, the people who put them into power. The level of corruption here is breathtaking. And now the Hill newspaper, this is the kind of inside politics newspaper on Capitol Hill in Washington, D.C. All the political junkies read it. Reports the congressional Republicans are planning to use the Gulf Coast disaster as an excuse to push another energy bill. More tax breaks for the oil industry. And yet ExxonMobil last month had the most profitable quarter of any corporation in American history. In American history. History, not just in the oil industry, of any industry. It just ain't right. They just spinning Katrina. Scott in San Diego, California, thoughts on this. Hey, Scott, welcome to the program.
Good morning, Tom. Thank you. Always a pleasure to talk with you. You know, first of all, I got to say, I've been listening to your show for a while, and I listen to a lot of different shows, and you do something no other radio host does, period, that I can find. You model conflict resolution on your program every day. And that is a skill that I can use all the time. So I really thank you for that.
Well, thank you for spotting that, Scott. I'm not sure I'm aware that I do it.
Well, modeling conflict resolution is you show an open interest and an opposing view.
Right.
You openly seek the other opinion. You value it evenly based upon your own education.
And then I give them hell.
Well, you also are very straightforward in saying I disagree or that's not right.
Yeah.
You never really raise your voice, and it's a great modeling program to listen to because it really helps when I get into discussions. In the
water cooler wars. What can I say?
Yeah, well, that's the theme of this show is helping people win the water cooler wars. And my point is that we all have Republicans in our families. We all have people who, you know, we have to interact with, people who you know, we live around, people that we work with. And at the end of the day, we still have to be friends with them, or we still have to be relatives with them, even if we have political differences with them. And I just hear so much political discourse in this country that is the goal of which is simply to bloody the other side. And it doesn't seem to me particularly useful.
We win at all costs.
Yeah, yeah. But in any case, Scott, I'm sure that's not what you called about.
The reason I called is last night I listened to a program we have in San Diego called Full Focus. And it's a really a good program. Last night was a great panel. A sociology professor, Black no less, at SDSU had said that he didn't blame Barbara Bush for her comment. I was appalled. I thought he mischaracterizes poverty and doesn't really understand it. My brother-in-law in New Orleans is working poor. He lives not quite paycheck to paycheck. There was no way they could get out of town. Their car's safe, by the way, but they couldn't get out of town. They didn't have gasoline for it.
Mm-hmm.
They have a gentleman that was there as a local pollster. I do not remember his exact name. I couldn't write it down. Nesbitt, something like that. And he said that in local polls here in San Diego that the people were evenly divided between blaming the local authorities, the governor and mayor, and blaming the federal government. I found that shocking after hearing what you said the other morning on your...
Yeah, I've been predicting this. In fact, I predict that, you know, the polls will be 60, 70, 80% blaming the mayor and the governor within another couple of weeks. I mean, don't underestimate what a few million dollars dropped by the Republican Party at the behest of Karl Rove with the absolute willingness to lie. To just plain old flat-out lie, like when Rove or whoever the senior administration official was, presumably it was Rove, lied to the Washington Post and said that the governor had not requested aid until Wednesday, when in fact she'd requested aid the day before the hurricane, and just lied to the Washington Post, and the Washington Post publishes it, and it's still being quoted by right-wingers.
I got a question for you that has stumped me since I studied journalism. Here's the thing. If I can't get to you as a source, I'm going to go to other sources that know you. I'm going to get some quotes. I'm going to say to you, I'm going to publish this unless you respond. That's how people used to do journalism. It seems that these journalists are lazy. They're not really reporting. If this outrage in New Orleans was reported from what I know of, more and more Americans would be completely outraged. Even a friend of mine who supports Bush and his response to New Orleans.
It's not so much lazy, Scott. What's going on is that when in 1987, when Ronald Reagan suspended the Fairness Doctrine. He suspended the rules that said, to a large extent, then Bill Clinton finished it with the Telecommunications Act. Between those two events, they suspended the rules that said that that companies that use the public airwaves, radio and TV stations, have to essentially perform a community service. And traditionally, what the networks had done was provide, as that community service, real news. When that requirement that news actually be news went away, then the networks and local radio stations and TV stations, for that matter, stopped worrying about whether or not the news was news and started thinking about how can we turn this into a profit center. And that's when, for example, I mean, it was a big deal when CBS merged their news division into their entertainment division. And what we have now is infotainment. We no longer have news in the United States. And that's the demise of democracy. And as a result of that, you've got people who are posing as news people, even with journalism school degrees in the White House, but whose huge salaries depend on their ability to have contact with people in the White House. And the Bush administration is saying, hey, you know, if you don't play our game, if you don't sing our tune, if you don't do what we say, we're going to cut you off. You won't be able to speak to the Bush administration anymore. And that means the end of the big salary. So it's just a very, very sick game that's being played. 14 minutes before the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
It's coming through a hole in the air from those gnats in Tiananmen Square. It's coming from the field that this ain't exactly real, or it's real but it ain't exactly there.
And welcome back.
From the war against disorder, from the sirens night and day, from the fires of the homeless, from the ashes of the gay. Democracy is coming to the USA.
Spoken like a good Canadian, Leonard Cohen. Welcome back. Well, we can hope. We can hope. And we're working for it. I mean, we are really and truly working toward democracy coming back to the United States of America. 4 minutes before the hour. excuse me, 9 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. 51 past. A couple of interesting updates here. President George W. Bush took responsibility today for any failures in the federal government's response to Hurricane Katrina. Well, at least he said he takes responsibility. I mean, the talk is cheap, George. He said, and I quote, "Katrina exposed serious problems in our response capability at all levels of government, and to the extent that the federal government fully didn't fully do its job right, I take responsibility." End quote. Is this an attempt to head off an investigation? I think so. I think he's trying to climb out of the poll hole, but I think he's also trying to head off any sort of a bipartisan or nonpartisan investigation. He doesn't want to be exposed for the screw-up that he is, that he did with this administration, that he went back to sleep, that he went back on vacation, that he wasn't paying attention, even though he had been briefed by Max Mayfield about what was coming. He's speaking at a joint news conference with Iraqi President Jalal Talabani. He said, "I want to know what went right and what went wrong. I want to know how to better cooperate with state and local government to be able to answer that very question that you asked. Are we capable?" See, he's reached the point where he can't deny reality anymore. This is the first time in 5 years that it's actually happened. But enough Americans saw enough happening that he has to say, yes, yeah, something went wrong. Finally. Yeah, something went wrong. And he's saying, I take responsibility. Well, what does that mean, Mr. Bush? I guarantee you it doesn't mean he's going to own up to his own actual failings. What it means is he's going to say, yes, I take responsibility for having hired that idiot Michael Brown, but he's gone now. Case closed. Let's move on. And then, of course, you have his mother on Larry King Live. Larry King asks her how she feels when people criticize her son, particularly about race, about, you know, all the African-Americans who are in harm's way down there in New Orleans. This was right after he flew over, you know, the flyover. Takes Air Force One down to 2,000 feet and banks so he can look out the window so they can take a nice picture of him looking out the window with a very concerned look on his face. That pretty soon the RNC will be selling for $5, like they did with the pictures of him on 9/11. Well, not $5, $25. So anyhow, here's Barbara Bush. She says, "But I really didn't hear that at all today. People came up to me all day long and said, 'God bless your son,' people of different races. And it was very, very moving and touching. And they felt like that when he flew over. It made all the difference in their lives." Get that? When George W. Bush flew over New Orleans, it made all the difference in their lives. Well, they were underprivileged to begin with, you have to understand. And moving along, Microsoft is on track to outsource. This is from the Business and Technology section of the Seattle Times. Microsoft is on track to outsource more than 1,000 jobs a year to China. Breyer Dudley wrote this, technology reporter for the Times. According to blistering evidence released yesterday in Microsoft's increasingly nasty spat with Google over an employee who jumped ship in June, apparently China's president Hu Jintao, a little upset that he's not getting more American jobs in China. Well, just give him time. Until we change our trade policies, this is just going to get worse and worse. This is absolutely nuts. Our country has been sold out by Reagan, Bush, Clinton, and Bush with regard to international trade. Jeff in Boulder, Colorado on the line. Hey, Jeff, what's up?
Hey, Tom, on that subject, tell me what I did wrong here. Saturday, I had the chance to talk to our Senate Majority Leader for a few minutes, and I was trying to get him to think about this globalization thing and especially the trade with China. And I asked him, I said, what are our, now that we have a Democratic Senate and Congress, what are we doing here to help local business? What are we doing to stop this tide of globalization? And he shut me right down real fast. I said, you know, we could go to Walmart and say, you know, it's great that you're doing business here, but let's concentrate on getting some local business stock on the shelves. And if you don't, we'll have this little bit of a tax that can then subsidize business growth here in Colorado. And he shut that down and said, there's no way that anything like that would pass. And we have a Republican governor.
Well, what you're trying to do is you're trying to, at the local level, change national policy. And it's going to be a very, very difficult thing to do. In fact, it's going to be nearly impossible. I mean, he's right in that regard. It may be that he's a DLC Democrat and he's all in favor of so-called free trade. I don't know. But the point is that that your suggestion was a good one, but what you were essentially suggesting was that a state start imposing tariffs. And it's you know, local communities, maybe. But, you know, and yesterday I was talking with the chief of staff for a member of the United States Senate, and he was trying to give me this free trade line. And he said, well, you know, people don't want to give up their cheap stuff at Walmart. And I said, I'll tell you what, if the price of everything, he says, you don't want to see the price of everything at Walmart going up 20%. And I said, I'll tell you what, if the price of everything at Walmart went up 20% because everything in Walmart was made in America like it was when Sam Walton was running it, and that meant that everybody's salaries went up 40% because now they've got good jobs making the stuff being sold in Walmart, I don't think people would mind that 20% price increase. And there was this long silence on the other end of the line. You know, and then he's like, well, that's a tough one to refute. And so, Jeff, we need to keep educating people. We need to keep spreading the word, sharing the word. But really, we have to create change at the national level. And that means taking back the House and Senate with the Democrats and getting the DLC out of the Democratic Party. And, you know, getting rid of the DLC Democrats like Lieberman and Bayh. Although, you know, let's get the Democrats in power. Jeff, thanks for the call.
Thanks, Tom.
Good to hear from you. I do appreciate it. The 43% of Americans gave Bush a passing grade in response to Hurricane Katrina, 54% disapproving, and 7 in 10 call for an independent probe of the federal response. This is the latest poll. We'll see you tomorrow.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.